Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a look back at the Vatican-China connection. Admiring a pictorial masterpiece hidden away on the Chaolian Hill. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. It may not have escaped your notice as to how on September 21st, China was given a new bishop in communion with Rome. The new bishop's name, by the way, is Joseph Li Shan, and he now heads the Diocese of Beijing, the Chinese capital. It's an ordination which comes on the heels of Pope Benedict XVI's recent letter to the bishops, priests, consecrated persons, and lay faithful of the Catholic Church in the People's Republic of China, released to the press on June the 30th this year, but which bears the date of Pentecost Sunday. A letter in which the Pope calls for respectful dialogue between church and state authorities, in which he expresses his love and closeness to Catholics in China, and which represents an effort to unite divided communities within the Catholic Church there. In the letter, he also expresses great joy for the fidelity shown by the faithful in China over the past 50 years. Should you wish to better examine this 55-page letter yourself, you can check out our Vatican website in several languages, including traditional and modern Chinese. The address is www.vatican.org. If you do so, you'll discover how in this letter Pope Benedict often quotes from his predecessor to the See of Peter, the late John Paul II, who once stated hope for a great harvest of faith in Asia in the third millennium. And if you stay tuned to this broadcast, in a few moments I'll be letting you hear, among other things, this late Pope's voice once again to Chinese Catholics as he speaks in South Korea in 1989. And indeed the voice of other popes of the 20th century who also expressed interest in this part of the world, including that of the first pilgrim pope, Paul VI, when he spoke to Catholics in China from Hong Kong in 1970. But first of all, to put things into context, I thought I'd offer you a bird's-eye view of the history of the Catholic Church in China over the past 50 years. Mao Zedong proclaims the Popular Republic of China in October 1949, almost four centuries after the arrival of Jesuit Matteo Ricci, who founded the modern mission of the Catholic Church in China. As soon as Chairman Mao establishes the communist regime, he proclaims his lean-to-one-side policy, meaning that China would not maintain a neutral position between the communist and non-communist worlds. In the following years, that's between 1949 and 1956, communist control was established over the church in China. In 1951, the Catholic bishops in China published an official document by the title of The Church in China, a declaration of principles which condemned the so-called national or independent Catholic Church in China as schismatic. A document this, which attempted to clarify the bishops' understanding of the three autonomies established by the communist regime, self-governing, self-supporting, self-propagating. In the bishops' understanding, then, self-governing meant that the Catholic Church would gradually establish an indigenous hierarchy. Self-supporting meaning support of the Church by Catholics from all countries. Self-propagating meaning that foreign missionaries would propagate the faith to serve the interests of local churches, not the interests of foreigners. This document also affirmed the importance of developing an indigenous hierarchy and the right to continue using foreign missionaries until the number of Chinese priests be sufficient to run the church. All that goes back to over half a century ago, when the Pope was Pius XII. But let's take a look at how he reacted to the situation in China, and indeed how other popes of the 20th century set a reconciliatory mode into motion. Spotlight then on a Vatican-China connection. Stay tuned. For over half a century, the Church in China lived through turbulent times and experienced a challenge of faith and hope through many winds of change. Before taking a brief look at some of these winds of change, I'd like to tell you a very Chinese story. It's from an ancient book by the title of Han Feste.
Over 500 years before Christ, there was a man named Bian He. He found a large stone which was actually an unpolished piece of jade. Bian He presented it to the emperor. The emperor saw nothing but a large stone, thought he was being tricked, and ordered Bian He's left foot to be chopped off. Bian He later sent the same present to the next emperor, who also saw only a stone, and ordered his right foot to be chopped off. When a third emperor came to the throne, Bian He held his jade in his arms outside the emperor's palace and wept 3 days and three nights. The emperor sent someone to investigate, then ordered the stone to be polished. Only then did they discover a beautiful jade inside it.
The person who told me this enchanting tale was Auxiliary Bishop of Hong Kong,
John Tong,
director of the Holy Spirit Study Centre, a research institute whose primary task is to gather, store and analyse pertinent data about China that will serve to broaden understanding of mainland China and to put into effect appropriate Christian responses to the rapidly changing situation there. But getting back to the tale, at the time, Bishop Tong remarked how our faith resembles this jade. And all Christians resemble
Bian He.
Because, he explained, as soon as we discover faith and prize it, we want to offer it to those who do not yet know it, and to persevere in doing so until death. What we can safely say is that the church in China is one of witness, of signs and stories of martyrs, the ones we know about and the ones never told. Emerging from a wounded church, which in the 20th century we often associated with a scenario rife with words such as persecution and again communism, cultural revolution. Witness, then, a word often used by the late Pope John Paul II.
Let's read a couple of lines from his 1999 encyclical,
Redemptoris Missio, on the permanent validity of the Church's mandate.
People today put more trust in witness than in teachers, in experience than in teaching, and in life and action than in theories. The witness of a Christian life is the first and irreplaceable form of mission. Christ, whose mission we continue, is the witness par excellence.
Fitting words for the situation of the church in China.
which for many years was described as divided, unfolding a black and white scenario. On the one hand, that of the so-called underground church, with its unswerving loyalty to the Holy See. On the other, the so-called patriotic association, founded in 1955, with its sympathisers, subject to external pressure. A scenario today no longer in place, with a complicated and confused result. With sometimes even the fine lines between one and the other blending together, as Bishop Tong once explained to me.
What is the correct terminology then?
Well, whatever you like to call it, okay. I mean, but nowadays we put it more proper way. We said there are some underground church members who are not recognized by the government. Yeah. And there's also many open church members, open church, instead of, we say, patriotic church members. Because patriotic associations is associations used or established by the government and used by the government to restrict and try to report the Catholic activities to the government. So they are the government's tool. Yeah, mainly is the tool of the government. Yeah. But after the reopening, since 1979, many Catholics seeing the tolerance situations in China given by the government, so they dare to come out to join the open church, because particularly some of the church ministers, clergy, priests and sisters want to use the rest of their life to serve their people, even with restricted capabilities, possibilities. So we cannot label them as patriotic church members. Yeah, use such a simple term to describe these people.
That process of reconciliation began in 1979 during the pontificate of John Paul II. Reaching its climax 10 years later, when, during a pastoral visit to South Korea, this Polish pontiff addressed Chinese Catholics, marking a slight change of emphasis from a previous speech to the same people from the Philippines back in 1981, offering us then yet another appeal for reconciliation, one even more earnest than the previous, as he underlines his concern for all members of the church in China without any distinction.
I also make mention of our brothers and sisters in Christ living in mainland China. I am deeply moved when I think of the heroic signs of fidelity to Christ and His Church, which many of them have shown in these past years. May the Lord also inspire within them a firm commitment to the delicate task of fostering reconciliation within the ecclesial community, in communion of faith with the successor of Peter, who is the visible principle and foundation of that unity.
Pope John Paul II reiterated this deep desire for reconciliation in the 1999 Asian Synod document, Ecclesia in Asia, when he prayed that the day would soon come when, he specified, our beloved Chinese brothers and sisters would be completely free to practice their faith in full communion with the See of Peter and the Universal Church, encouraging them at the same time in this document never to allow hardship and sorrow
to diminish their devotion to Christ and commitment to a great nation. But while this Pope clearly saw the potential of an open church in China in full communion with the Universal Church, the path to paving the way towards reconciliation between the Church in China and Rome offers many milestones. I'd like to mention some of the contributions from the 20th century popes who came before him. As I have no sound to offer you from 1926, when Pius XI personally consecrated in St. Peter's Basilica the first six Chinese bishops, I'd like to begin with Pope Pius XII, who in the 1950s issued three encyclicals focusing on the Catholic Church in China.
In 1951, the apostolic letter Cupimus Imprimis, or the Catholic Church in China, compares the situation there with the persecution of the early church. The encyclical praises Chinese Catholics for their fidelity, highlighting how inappropriate it is to set up national churches that might destroy the unity established by Christ. 1954, the encyclical Ad Sinarum Gentem, or To the People of China, defends missionary enterprise and distinctly rejects the independent church movement, affirming the necessity on the basis of Christian charity to allow for ties of mutual support in the Catholic Church the world over. It also contains a strong public criticism of communism, which deeply offends Chinese leaders, who then confront the Catholic Church even more boldly.
1955, the Bishop of Shanghai, Ignatius Gong Pingmei, is arrested together with a consistent number of priests, sisters and lay Catholics. At the time, Bishop Gong was one of the strongest opponents of an independent Catholic Church, and his diocese of Shanghai the main stronghold of opposition. A few months later, some 15,000 Catholics are arrested, among them several seminarians and priests, while in Guangzhou, Bishop Dominic Tang is thrown into prison. But getting back to Pius XII's third encyclical.
1958, the encyclical Ad Apostolorum Principis, or At the Tomb of the Prince of the Apostles, responds to the news of the ordination of 13 so-called patriotic bishops in six different Chinese dioceses without the approval of Rome. In this document, Pius XII expresses disapproval of the Catholic Patriotic Association. To no avail, however. From 1958 to 1962, at least 52 bishops are ordained without Rome's approval.
Meanwhile, the Pope to follow Pius XII and these encyclicals is John XXIII, who sets the ground for a softer approach within the Church in China, encouraging an attitude of reconciliation, attempting a more prayerful understanding. His words fell on deaf ears. As for the next pope in line, Paul VI, his name has gone down in history as supporting China's membership at the United Nations. He was the first pilgrim pope and also the first Roman pontiff in history to visit what was then a neighbouring nation to China, Hong Kong. Hong Kong, a diocese which has stayed in touch over the years with Catholics in mainland China, given an essential part of its church's mission, has been to act as a bridge to China and to the church in China. An awareness shown by Paul VI when he visited there in December 1970. The place was Hong Kong's Happy Valley. When he said with deep emotion,
we had around us, we almost feel it. All the Chinese people, wherever they may be. There comes to this far eastern land, for the first time in history, the humble apostle of Christ that we are. And what does he say? Why does he come? To sum it up in one word, love. Christ is a teacher, a shepherd, and a loving redeemer for China too.
I hope you enjoyed this collage of mine on the popes and China. Meanwhile, time to change the subject, moving on to find out more about an Umbrian masterpiece depicting Our Lady, dating back to the late 1400s, signed Antoniazzo Romano. Housed in the sacristy of the Church of San Giovanni e Paolo, it was once removed from Rome by no other than Napoleon, who before returning it housed it for a while in the Louvre. Join me as I go there with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis.
As you see, this painting here has echoes of an influence of Perugino, a very clear influence, because every time I see paintings by Perugino, I know I'm going to find 4,500 little angels. I mean, maybe you see 10 of them, but the others, you know, they're there, even if you don't see them. He has a lovely, sweet way of depicting the tranquility of little seraphim and cherubims. So you see faces, little wings, and they're all, in this case here, all of the angels are around an oval piece in the middle.
It has an almond-shaped frame.
In fact, she's called a mandorla. And literally sitting inside this, almost like she's suspended in air, is the Madonna, dressed in very dark robes, dark blue robes with a red robe underneath, with the Christ child. Literally, it looks like he's actually standing on her dress. You see, it's a very dark robe. So dark, it reminds us actually a little bit of early Byzantine paintings when robes on women and men were made to look very flat. Child Jesus looks like he's literally standing in the air because he's not sitting on her knee per se. And you have four saints each side, each wearing a halo, one of which is John the Baptist and the other is Saint Jerome. We associate faces done by Perugino as being very ethereal and very fine-featured. These particular figures here are actually quite rough. You can see the two figures in the front in particular. Antoniazzo has made them look quite old and sort of raggedy in a sense now. And again, John the Baptist, which is a strange thing there, he's wearing robes the colour of violet, the same as God the Father in the Sistine Chapel. So this particular kind of colours, you don't find it that often, but it's a sort of a pinky-violet mix. Very, very unusual, but very luminous colour. And again, with the halos, you can see the six halos, actually, if you count the baby.
Golden halos.
Yeah, they're really strong. When you look at the painting as you walk in, the first thing you see are the halos. So the gold is coming at you. You know, little circles of gold are coming down the sacristy to meet your eyes, and they pull you into the painting. And you see, look at the bottom there, where the Madonna is. Just below her, if you look into the back, there's a little opening with little sort of green Umbrian hills, and you can see a beautiful landscape way behind the Madonna. So she's almost like she's suspended in air. It's lovely because he hasn't tried to put her into a kind of architectural setting. He's left her floating between heaven and earth, which is obviously where she is, you know. And then look below, the face of the lion beside St. Jerome. The face looks like a human face, actually. You see that little brown line? The legs look almost like a dog's rather than a lion's. Because this church outside the main door of San Giovanni Paolo, one of the things I love about entering this basilica is immediately you see two marble, antique marble lines each side of the door, and they looked like somebody chopped their noses off. But they didn't chop the nose off one, they chopped the nose off of both of them. So it's hard to know why that happened, or maybe people who had them considered them to be pagan elements. But and then they rethought it out afterwards, using it in terms of Mark and the lion, you know. So, but the lion here, he's painted this in a sort of playful manner. But what I find wonderful, I think, is the fact that they all have this sense of suspension. They're all hanging between heaven and earth, and they're pulling us into it. We're part of the expression of the other world. So we're invited to participate in an expression of the other world, where the painter shows you that, okay, it's happening, but it's happening in a way that's almost not natural. The Madonna in the air, she looks like she's surrounded by little bees almost. These angels look like little bees. There's something beautiful and moving. There's a sense of energy in the painting. No? Playful. No?
Buzzing angels.
Brina, the robe of Our Lady, you said it was dark blue. Yeah. It's very unusual to have such a dark colour on Our Lady, isn't it?
Well, those are colours that were used in early Byzantine art for the Madonna. You'll always find her in certainly in some frescoes, like the old ones that they've now found in San Clemente, for example. It's like a navy blue, what we would associate with a navy blue, with little binding of gold on the edges, or maybe sometimes dark green. But always a blue, it has to be, because those are her colours, the blue and the red, and which are actually the same colours, obviously, that Christ wears. Yeah.
And the turquoise is a strange colour for the sky, isn't it?
Well, the turquoise, that's what they call aquamarine in a way, was one of the most important colours and the most difficult colours to use. Aquamarine, a turquoise colour from the east, was an expensive business, even in the Sistine Chapel. I mean, most painters asked the patrons to buy this colour for them before they started work, because they knew that once they entered and started the work, that the expense for this type of colour was quite extensive. But Perugino used it a lot also on paintings. He used it on top of other paintings or mixed with other paintings to give them a kind of pearl, a sense of light inside the colour. So here, this turquoise would be something that I would, turquoise, I would associate very much with Perugino and his way of glazing his landscapes and making his landscapes look to get that soft night, soft evening light, you know, that sort of half light.
Like Perugino, it's very defined too.
Yes, yes. Perugino always defines very clearly and very quietly and very serenely his images. And Tonazzo here is, I would say he's more energetic and more, let's say, more aggressive in his use of the brushes and making his figures. But at the same time, he does maintain, by the use of the colour, this sort of ethereal harmony, this type of floating sensation that you get from this painting. You feel that if you hang on to the mandala, you can float off. You can actually go away with the Madonna, which is a lovely idea.
Well, thanks there, as always, to Brida Ennis, the Professor of Fine Arts, currently working at the American University of Rome. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.